We've been trying to move this struggle from a lower to a higher level.
This is Voices with Vision, bringing you news and analysis.
It's about cutting-edge social justice issues by mixing various voices and ideas
with information, cultural expressions, and commentary.
Voices with Vision airs every Tuesday on your Jazz and Justice station, WPFW.
Good morning, sisters and brothers, comrades and friends. Welcome to the November 11th edition of Voices with Vision, the show not for the politically faint of heart, because we keep it real, sometimes too real for those of you who want to hold on to any semblance of the oppressive system. I'm Netfer Freeman, one of your co-hosts in our virtual studio with your other co-host, Brother Craig. What's going on, Brother Craig?
Hey, good morning to you, Netfer, and good morning to all of our listeners and podcast subscribers, and a special shout out to our veterans. That's right, our veterans of the liberation struggles around the world, fighting for freedom and the end to the tyranny of imperialism and capitalism everywhere. So if you're a veteran of SNCC, the Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Army, Republic of New Africa, New African People's Organization, the All African People's Revolutionary Party, ZANU-PF, FRELIMO, MPLA, PAIGC, Convention People's Party, the Eritrean People's Liberation Front, American Indian Movement, Sinn Féin, and the IRA, etc., we salute you and thank you for your service.
Uh-oh, see what I mean? And we have a couple guests this morning from the front lines of the struggle who will be sharing their work and analysis with us around some of the issues we're facing here in the U.S. and globally. I'm speaking about Comrade Oliver of PACA, Pan-African Community Action, who will be talking to us about the juvenile curfew that is in effect in D.C. Then Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Army veteran and former political prisoner, Daruba Bin Wahad, who will help us put this moment of rising global fascism and resistance into perspective. For all the U.S. held and Israeli held Palestinian political prisoners languishing behind prison walls, what's the call?
Free them all.
I've noticed black people have the genius to put the curse word after they say the race of the person. We're white dudes, we always put it in front. And if we would just make that little adjustment, we could save so many careers, so many jobs could be saved in the white community if we would just put it after. You never notice that in conversation here, black guy, you're like, man, I was standing there, this Asian mother came in, he starts talking about my... You don't even hear it. You're just sitting there, oh, what did this Asian mother do? I would love to hear the rest of this story, right? Dude, I would tell the exact same story, right? I'm standing there, right? This f***ing Asian comes in, right? Everybody's all like, whoa, whoa, hey, easy, easy, Jesus, dude. What year is it, you know? It's like, dude, I just said what he said. I just preempted the f***. That's all I did. He suggested he's hooking up with people's mothers. I'm not even doing that. It's just a quick, I got it out of the way. I got it out of the way.
Netfer Freeman here, in the virtual studio with Brother Craig. We're going to unpack this relatively recent emergency curfew legislation that the DC government has passed, the Juvenile Curfew Second Emergency Amendment Act of 2025. It took effect November 7th. It seemed to be in response to a lot of tension marked in the media by some events that happened at the Navy Yard sometime very recently. Maybe y'all with some young people were congregating, and then there was a, you know, a clash and some tensions with the National Guard that are here. We want to unpack that, not only what happened, but also the response of the state with this curfew. From a revolutionary perspective, and invited here to help us do that is a brother from Pan-African Community Action, no stranger to the airwaves of Voices with Vision, is Oliver. What's up, Brother Oliver? How you doing?
Peace, peace. Thank you for having me.
Let's get right into it. It's a lot to get into, and we don't have a lot of time. Now, the curfew law is an extension of previous laws enacted. The government says it's to an emergency. So what emergency are we talking about here? How is it being framed as an emergency, teenagers being out past, you know, a certain time? And how is it that a so-called condition of emergency has been leveraged into legislation in various forms since 1995?
I think that's the right place to start. What is this emergency, and is there one? Which sort of assumed, right, when you take this type of punitive recourse, that you're responding to a quote-unquote emergency. But if we look at what actually happened, we have teenagers out on Halloween, the way teenagers are, meeting a massive federal and police response, really for being out in public. In a lot of ways, it is in fact the response that escalates the situation. It's being met with National Guardsmen armed with weaponry and in large numbers meeting youth who are out in public in Halloween. So in a certain way, the event itself lends itself to this kind of escalation because the spectacle is created. The fear-mongering around teens in public congregating in large numbers, particularly, right, black kids in this instance, congregating in large numbers, it's what's being framed as the emergency. And I think it's important, as you named, to note that this isn't unique, right? These types of incidents, these types of clashes are pioneered and reconfigured into justification for these type of curfews. Never, though, what is mentioned is what are the conditions being produced in DC and in all other places that youth are responding to? In which ways have youth been neglected by these very systems that are applying these curfews? And then also, what does a curfew mean going forward? How does that further support the very populations that it's claiming to protect? And that's where I think the contradiction of this even really being about safety starts to come into play.
Thank you, Oliver. And looking at, you know, some of the details of this juvenile curfew emergency law, we see that there's some provisions that give specific formations. I'm talking about ANCs, BIDs, that's the business development organizations, and something called Main Street organizations, gives them the power to petition for an expansion of a curfew into what they're calling their neighborhood. Can you tell us what are these formations, who typically controls them, and if there's any provision for neighborhood organizations to demand that a curfew be removed?
Yeah. So, and I think that's important to note, right? Largely all the organizations you name, obviously ANC is more of a neighborhood governmental structure as far as there being an ANC, right, representative in each ward and folks in a given ward being able to attend ANC meetings to weigh in on community developments, right? Whereas the business associations, these are more tied to businesses in the area who are coming together to advocate for certain interests. I think what's interesting in thinking about where the reaction to youth is, it's primarily in the Navy Yard area. It's primarily in these commercial zones, zoned for lots of economic retail. These are growing areas. These have more affluent, mostly white populations. So in that respect, a lot of these, whether it's these local ANCs or business organizations, they're leveraging their influence. They're leveraging their influence to instate curfew really to protect a commercial interest in the area, that it's not as viable economically to have what they're calling large groups of Black youth disrupting the flow of who's consuming, who's traveling into the area, right? It's hurting their bottom line, so to speak. I think in the reverse, though, you could imagine that it would be possible for an ANC to push against a curfew, but we're not seeing ANCs or business associations in Southeast DC, right, predominantly Black neighborhoods, pushing these curfews. These curfews are beginning and starting in the high traffic and highly affluent areas with lots of commercial activity. And there's something, you know, particular about that, those are the areas they're trying to keep youth out of, right? The areas where there's stores, the areas where there's shopping, where there's fine dining, right? The areas of the city that are being cornered off and saying, you don't belong here. We're drawing up these boundaries in those particular places. We're not seeing in Ward 8, where there's also an ANC, we're not seeing curfews being enacted there. We're not seeing this heavy enforcement in some of these areas. So I think there's a way in which, you know, yes, it certainly would be possible any of these governmental or economic organizations could leverage or advocate for and against a curfew. But I think if we think about who's leveraging that influence here, it's for a particular purpose, right? It's for a particular commercial and economic agenda that they view, you know, Black youth as being prohibitive of.
In conjunction with that economic agenda, on the political side, we see in the past city officials insisting that this curfew is going to be enforced in some kind of benevolent way, that offenders will be taken to community centers where they can access some undefined services and resources. Does this law substantiate any of those types of promises? And what are the penalties in the law for violators? And who do these penalties affect, for instance, parents?
Even starting with what you just said, right? I mean, this idea that there's a benevolent way of taking you and forcing you to go somewhere, right? That we even have to start unpacking that maybe initially, that, right, where is the benevolence in you are going about your night and I am now forcibly seizing you and taking you somewhere, right? Or forcing you to go somewhere, right? Regardless of what services exist on the other side, right? I think that's in the first instance, right? Where is that being justified by this idea that the police, the National Guard, or otherwise should be taking custody of youth for being out too late and forcing them to go anywhere, right? But I think the other side, if we kind of dig into the actual curfew law itself, one, you have heavy fines, right? You have fines, I think, of $500 for folks who aid youth in breaking curfew, which, what does that mean, to aid youth in breaking curfew? Does that mean if you're over 18 with somebody that's under the age of the curfew that you'll be fined for being with them? And also we have penalties for youth, you know, I think including community service for breaking this curfew. So we're talking about, again, economically and socially prohibitive punishments for simply being out too late. And in what way is that conducive to supporting youth or keeping them safe? At the end of this, what you owe money? Is that what a curfew is meant to do? Is it's going to be this economic tax on mostly Black working class teens and their families who inevitably have to pay these fines, have to bring kids to community service or whatever community centers. So in a way, right, it's just part of the broader punishment, I would say, and how it's being viewed. But even if we look at how the curfew is being, you know, enforced on its face and the particular, you know, provisions, they particularly, and I'll just point out too, they particularly highlight, right, that running an errand, right, for a parent or guardian without detour is an exception to a curfew. My immediate question would be, what does it mean to be without detour? And who qualifies what is or is not an errand, right? To me, that sounds like a pretense to stop anybody, no matter where they're going. You know, what kind of exception does that create? You know, another one is coming to or from work without detour. Again, unless you stop me, detain me, go through all my stuff, right, investigate who I am, how do you suppose that you find out if I'm coming to or from work, right? So even in the language of the curfew, whether it's the way it's being enforced or the way it's being enacted, it is just given greater license to surveil, to detain, to control where people go, control movement. And, you know, we think about this being, you know, an extension of this war against Black youth, Black teens that we kind of are seeing for decades. There's a way in which, even on its face, without even thinking about the political impact that they're attempting to have, actually what's written on paper just gives license for the youth to be targeted in ways that we see time and time again.
You mentioned the war on Black youth that we've been seeing, and I think it brings us to this, the more overall arching analysis. I know Paca asserts that African people or Black people in the U.S. are a domestic colony, internal colony within the United States. The stuff we're talking about now will seem to most people evidently would not apply across the board to all youth. That we know that it's particular to Black youth, which denotes not just to racism, but a colonialism, that internal colony thing. We can even say the evidence was, and I think it was you sharing with me that someone shared that Instagram post where they showed the police selectively letting some people go on the metro and stopping other people.
Yes.
Tie in this domestic colonialism. That how should people understand it? Because is it not correct that if, in fact, we're dealing with a question of colonialism, and anti-capitalism and imperialism and those things, that the United States is really an extension, or the nature of it is a white supremacist ethno-fascist state. That means then more than reform has to be the solution. What is Paca saying, and how does this internal colonialism analysis help us understand what we're dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, I think the colonial question, it immediately raises this idea that, again, it's not about safety. It's not about any justice. It's not about making sure youth get home at night. We're talking about a population that the state is aware is primed for resistance, is primed for indignation, has been ostracized and labeled as disposable by the system in terms of thinking about the other root issues that are not addressed. The youth not having safe or public spaces to go to, the cutting of social programs, the fact that jobs at a wide scale are not available to young people, basic needs like health and healthcare costs are going up, housing is being denied to family, right? There's a state in which you're putting people in a place of desperation, particularly youth, and that youth will be out in the streets in response to a system that is failing to meet people's basic needs. And that it's in the face of that indignation, right, where the colonial question comes in, that it's about maintaining this occupation. This is a population that has to be controlled. They have to be kept out of certain wards, certain areas. They have to be confined to a particular location. In the same way we see colonial administrations all around the world, whether it's South Africa, where people have to show their papers, they're being surveilled, there's different checkpoints, whether we're talking about the Palestinians in Gaza, where obviously we have very explicit checkpoints, not to draw a perfect analogy to all those situations, but more so to assert that colonial control always carries with it this level of surveillance, this level of domination, control of movement, particularly young people who will be agitated, right, and indignant to a system that's denying them the basic human rights that they know, you know, almost intuitively that they deserve. So I think that part of how we should think about it, whether it's PACA, but just in terms of building a mass movement in general, thinking about the collective humanity that we all need to fight for, this is a system that has to be disrupted. It has to be overthrown. It can only be challenged by organizing the youth, right? Channeling this rage and frustration that folks are feeling into more organized resistance. And I think that looks like many different things. That looks like the consciousness raising, right? That looks like building the political consciousness of what the system is and what it's doing to people. I think that looks like building institution alternatives for youth to be a part of, to lead, right, to become political actors and building their own forms of self-determination as a community. And again, it also looks like direct resistance. It looks like direct resistance to the settler colonial forces that are imposing this type of occupation on the youth. It's really a revolutionary challenge. There's nothing short of that. The only way to address the type of colonial control we're seeing, the surveillance, the expansion of policing, the way that our youth are harassed, they're targeted, they're brutalized, is to build a mass movement for power. And that has to involve the youth. We can't ignore the youth in that. We have to organize them to take part of that and be agents of that struggle. And that's the only way that we address these issues. More curfews is not going to meet anybody's needs. More curfews is not going to keep anybody safe. And as a community, there's often this, you know, fear of our own youth, right? That's a political question as well. You'll have folks that'll say, well, somebody's got to get the youth under control. It's not a matter of control. It's a matter of organization. We must be part of helping our youth be organized to respond to the crises they're just reacting to in their own communities. I think that's the deeper question, right? That's the question that organizations like PACA have to seek to answer.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like if we were to tie this in, we should always do that, because if what we're saying is true, or what you're saying is true, not me, you said it, not me, no. But then we have to also tie it in the how is it relevant to what's going on internationally? And you're seeing youth all over Africa and Kenya, Tanzania, other places standing up, with, you know, happening on the in West Africa, even on the state level in Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. Let's make some international connections and relevances and how we connect it concretely. This same state that's doing this, of course, this is local, you know, policies, but international policies, see them killing people with impunity in the open waters off of Venezuela. What kind of connections? How can people be convinced that these things are interrelated?
Yeah, I think part of it is it's a question of identity. It's a question of identification, I think, with the resistance that we're seeing broadly across the global South and across the world. It's the same enemy, right? The same rampant disregard and brutish type of violence that is being utilized to kill and target the people of Venezuela, to kill youth resisting on the continent of Africa, to kill Palestinian youth leading resistance in Gaza. It's the same brute and rampant disregard for life that's being applied to our youth when somebody is shot by the police in the street. You know, these instances where we see people left in the street for hours after being shot. We're seeing that same type of rampant disregard being predominated by the same enemy in all these fronts. But then I think there's also, again, a way in which we're united in common interest, right? In the outrage, particularly if we take Burkina Faso as an example, the outrage by the West, by the collective West against Burkina Faso, is that they're daring to assert a cultural and economic sovereignty that no longer, you know, centers or includes French influence over language, over economy, over culture, and they're asserting control of their resources and control of the very, you know, politics that should shape their nation, right? These are questions of self-determination. And where I think that connects to youth, and perhaps where we need to make it more clear to folks, is that the indignation, the rage that we're seeing, the rage in public spaces, right? The rage against perhaps what youth have not identified as the same enemy, but they can tell that there's an us versus them dynamic. They can tell they're being rooted out of public spaces. They can tell that their cultural and social expressions are not being wanted or warranted. At the root of that, I think, is the same resistance against a common enemy, which is this Western Eurocentric settler colonial cultural domination and economic domination, which are one and the same. So the cultural alienation of our youth here, the joblessness, right, the lack of healthcare, the lack of housing that folks are facing, at its root is the same issue we're seeing around the world, where the collective West is warring against those who dare to oppose its resistance. I think we have to see our youth and the indignation of our youth as ripe for being just another arm of that broader struggle, right? Our youth are here, and this is a front of that same struggle. And what's missing here, perhaps, is the organization. And that organization is meant to clarify, I think, what's already here, as opposed to us having to force a connection, right? I think that our youth are ripe to be part of these broader struggles that we're seeing. This is just another front.
You know, Oliver, you kind of answered a question that I wanted to ask, which was about the youth and their families, you know, that are affected by this whole curfew and these penalties and all this surveillance and the National Guard, for instance, and what we can do to push back. You mentioned organization. You mentioned political education and consciousness. Can you talk about things that concrete things that you might be involved in that area?
Yeah. So thinking about PACA's work in particular, two aspects of our work that I can speak to here is obviously from the political consciousness building. This PACA is a status quo study group. And that is a model of popular education, right? A form where we're bringing people in to have discussions on these topics, but also grow our collective understanding as a community, right? We're trying to build the political minds that are necessary to develop organized resistance. And part of what we're thinking about with ASSG now, connected to these issues, is issues particular to healthcare. And we have actually a session coming up this week that speaks again on this issue of healthcare, which we know can't be really disconnected from these safety issues we're seeing with youth. But that session is privatized healthcare, insurance exploitation, and healthcare is a human right, right? Which I think actually falls right in line with what we're talking about, as far as the type of root issues the youth are dealing with. You know, so that's a session that, you know, we, in terms of building community, right? We want people to come out to that. And that's actually this Wednesday, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Black Workers and Wellness Center, which is over by Anacostia Metro. It's a 2500 Martin Luther King Avenue. And we really want folks to come out to that, right? Part of the community building, the consciousness raising I'm talking about, requires folks to come together for these type of discussions. The folks can register for that. We want folks to register in advance just so we can get a sense of how many people are coming. You can do that at privatehealthcareandhumanrights.eventbrite.com. Again, that's private. Healthcare and human rights that eventbrite.com this Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Black Workers and Wellness Center. But other ways we're thinking about building these things more concretely is through our efforts to address community control of health. And in that, we necessarily respond to the types of health issues that youth are dealing with, but also families broadly, right? Thinking about health overall. So that's a program we're trying to get started, right? The People's Pan-African Wellness Front is an initiative by PACA that we're trying to get started at the top of next year. In order to do that, we're seeking to raise some money, really to support that program, generate some interest. So we have actually a fundraising event coming up. It's November 22nd from 5 to 9 p.m. at the Palestinian Freedom House. And that's actually both a celebration of PACA's 10th anniversary, as well as a fundraiser to raise money for our health program. So again, that's 5 to 9 p.m. Would love for folks to come out to that as well. It's at the Palestinian Freedom House. And again, it's another forum in which we're trying to popularize these ideas and kind of build the consciousness we need for the type of mass movement we know is necessary. And so if folks want to come out to this fundraising event for PACA's 10th anniversary, we want folks to register there again. That's PACAturns10.eventbrite.com. If folks want to register and come out to that, PACAturns10.eventbrite.com. We'd love to get a full house for that event as well.
Thank you very much. We're speaking with Oliver from Pan-African Community Action, bringing down a lot of timely, cutting-edge stuff. Thank you, Oliver, for joining us again.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
So let's hold it right there to find out what's happening in the social justice calendar. We'll be right back.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of Monday, November 10th, 2025. Tuesday, November 11th, Veterans Day, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., there will be a reading of the names of Black soldiers who fought in the Civil War at African American Civil War Memorial. There will be a list of names upon arrival for those who wish to participate. Children and adults of all ages are welcome. For more info, visit the website afroamcivilwar.org. Wednesday, November 12th, is Pan-African Community Action's next Asada Shakur Study Group session, Privatized Healthcare, Insurance, Exploitation, and Healthcare as a Human Right, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Black Workers and Wellness Center on 2500 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More info and registration is on privatehealthcareandhumanrights.eventbrite.com. Thursday, November 13th at 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m., there will be a general info session of the work Harriet's Wildest Dreams is engaged in. If you're interested in building a better world, free from patriarchal violence, free of harm for queer people and people of color, this is what this event is all about. They will reimagine what this world can be and reclaim safety for all of D.C. For more info, visit harrietsdreams.org. On Sunday, November 16th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., Haile Gerima and Sankofa Video and Books will hold a space of artistic expression and protest, featuring a special musical performance by Munit Mesfin, located at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit sankofa.com. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
You're listening to Voices with Vision, the show that's not for the politically faint of heart on your Jazz and Justice station. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
We're back in the virtual studio, and we got a wrap-up conversation. There's a lot going on. So we brought in a brother, comrade, big brother, who's going to tie in not only the topic we dealt earlier in the previous segment, but even one we're going to deal with next week on Venezuela and just everything, all the world stuff. We need people, veterans from the movement who have insight on the revolutionary dispositions we're supposed to have, who can tie in everything we're going through from the local purview that we exist in and the international perspective and dynamics that are happening. Who best to do that than our brother Daruba Ben-Wahab, a veteran of the Black Liberation African Pan-African Liberation Movement, really, former political prisoner, Black Liberation Army veteran, all that. Brother Yoruba, welcome back to Voices with Vision. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to kick it with you, comrade.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to just open this up with a very open-ended kind of general question, because we were talking earlier today and some of the terms that we were using, the concepts, I helped ground us in what we were dealing with, what's happening on the continent, the Pan-Africanism and everything, the resistance on the continent, along with this white supremacist. What's the term you use? I just used it for my brother.
Ethno-Christian, white supremacist, jingoistic nationalism.
Right.
That's what it is.
And that concept, I think, it helps us, because Paca and a lot of us now are asserting that we are an internal colony within the U.S. And with all the analysis we can give into internal colonialism and domestic colonialism, that, I think, helps us understand that this is the state and the society that we're dealing with is what you describe, white supremacist, ethno-Christian, ethno-nationalist construct. How is that relevant to what we would say is the fascism, the nature of the fascism we're dealing with now, and an internationalist, imperialist fascism we're experiencing?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think, like Alhaj Malik Shabazz, Malcolm X said, history is the best subject to reward or research. And if we go back almost a century, we could see that with the breakup of the empires, the German Empire, the Russian Empire, the breakup of those empires at the beginning of World War I, it led to the devastation of Europe and the loss of millions. An entire generation was lost in the first industrial cataclysmic war, and that war resulted in the birth of dozens of nations in Europe that had broke away from the old empires and established themselves. But long before then, these same empires were the ones that had colonized Africa, and they had met at the end of the 19th century to divvy up Africa. And this was the nations, the empires of France, Britain, Spain, the feeble remains of the Portuguese, and they divvied up Africa for their own, the Belgians and everything, for their own resources. But World War I collapsed many of these economies. And so the winners of World War I, the victors of World War I, first of all, had to create a new world order, a new legal disposition. But they all agreed that they should never again engage in the type of conflict that would devastate their economies and their peoples again. So they set up the League of Nations. And the League of Nations was supposed to regulate disagreements between new nations and old empires, and adjudicate various territorial disputes, especially amongst colonizing nations in Africa. Well, this came to a screeching halt, of course, with the outbreak of World War II when the Japanese invaded China and walked out of the League of Nations. And Hitler began to rearm and remilitarize Germany against the Versailles Treaty. So the League of Nations wallowed, and the West plunged itself into war. And this time, this war had a unique feature. There was this genocidal fascism, this rise of fascism in Europe that focused on Roma people, on Ashkenazi European Jewry. The bane of Europe since the fall of Moorish Spain and the Spanish Inquisition has always been this obsession with European Ashkenazi Jewry. There were numerous pogroms that were carried on, but in World War II, fascism had risen to its height. And now we need to understand that historically, the major obstacle to the rise of fascism and the rise of this cult of white supremacy in Europe were the communists. They were the major ones that talked about organizing the masses of people, that talked about organizing workers. So they were the major bane of the rise of the authoritarian fascism. Because if we understand fascism simply as the union and the marriage between the rich and the industrial elite and the state, then we could understand that we're talking about a system in which wealth and privilege and power and industrial control of working class people determine the policies of the state, okay, determine how they deal with working people in all aspects of their lives. So the major obstacle to this move towards authoritarian and oligarchy control of the state under fascism was the communists. So when Europe was plunged into war and Hitler invaded Poland and the lowlands and they plunged into war, this great struggle against fascism came into vivid display. The Allies, the British, whose empire was being squeezed by both the Nazis and the Japanese in India, in Southeast Asia, and very livelihood of survival of Britain, you know, under the attack of Nazi Germany, the occupation of Europe by the Nazis in 1940, all marked a high water tide of fascism in Europe and in the West. And many of the robber barons, many of the elite and rich and industrialists of America supported the Nazis. Rockefeller supported the Nazis. Ford supported the Nazis. They supported the Nazis. This was the beginning of what we would see as the global oligarchy, the global elite that would emerge after the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War. But anyway, the Allies were victorious in 1945, and they did the same thing or similar thing as they did at the end of World War I. Instead of creating the League of Nations, they created the United Nations. They created the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, to revitalize the crushed imperial economies of France and Italy and Germany. And they created the World Bank. And in 1948, of course, they recognized the European settler state, Zionist State of Israel. When there was a global sympathy, when there was a global sympathy for Jews who were slaughtered in Europe by German fascism, and so if we trace the lineage or the history of why Western Asia was chosen as the outpost of European hegemony in a very crucial and strategic region that borders on Africa, Eastern Europe, and Western Asia, is that the League of Nations, when it dissolved in 1943, I believe, before the end of the war, while the war was being waged, created a mandate for the Middle East and gave it to the British. And the British were the ones that were supposed to supervise this mandate at the end of World War II. And they were given this mandate. Coincidentally, it was the Balfour Declaration 50 years before that was submitted to Lord Balfour by the Rothschilds. It was a declaration or a proposal to the British Empire to create a Zionist European settler state, a Jewish state in Western Asia. Mm-hmm. So I just want to encapsulate that at the end of each one of these wars, the West and Europe had to restructure the global economy and the global architecture of trade. And they always did so to their benefit. They did so to empower the French to try to recapture their empires in Southeast Asia. They failed in 1954, Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam. They failed in Algeria later on. And they had to concede to the revolutionary demands of liberation movements in Africa, from Kenya to West Africa. So this world order that they created at that time is now unraveling. And it's unraveling at a breakneck speed because of the evolution of technology, our ability to instantly communicate with each other, and also because of the last settler state, of the last European settler state in the epoch of settler states, which is Israel. Israel is the last settler state of the colonial era of the 19th and 20th century. The United States was founded as a breakaway colony of the British Empire. So the United States itself is a European settler state. Canada is a European settler state. New Zealand is a European settler state. Australia is a European settler state. And we've noticed that all throughout the genocide that has been going on in Western Asia and Gaza since for 2 years, that all of these nations backed and supported unilaterally unconditionally the European settled state of Israel, claiming that it was the only democracy in the region and had a right to self-defense. So we need to understand that we arrived at where we are at today, not by coincidence, but by design. And it has been the rich, the global oligarchs, the ones that have grown rich off of fossil fuel, that has grown rich off of stealing the minerals from Africa, now see their entire edifice being threatened by the rise of the global South, by BRICS, by nations that were once colonized. The whole United Nations agrees. Many of them weren't even around in 1945 when the UN was created. But they all agree that the European settler state of Israel is an occupying force, that the Palestinian people are being forced to pay penalties for the racism and genocide of Germany against the European Jews, and that this is unfair. And they recognize the right of the Palestinians to self-determination. The only one stopping this, the only ones that have stood in the way, is one nation, and that's the European settler state or colonizing state or republic of the United States of America. And and so this comes home to us in the form of ethnic cleansing. This comes home to us in the form of understanding why Europe, in Trump's speech at the United Nations just recently, said that if Europeans didn't close their borders to migrants seeking to invade their territory and invade their cultures, then they're doomed. So the Europeans have closed their borders, or are closing their borders to immigrations and migrations. That's the number one subject on the mind of every European nation state, including the United States.
So you're saying it's not just Trump, huh?
No, this is a phenomenon that grew out of this historical continuum that I just briefly went through. No, it's not just Trump. He's not the cause of none of this. He's a product of it. He's a product of the unique so-called democratic system of the Electoral College system in America. It's not a democracy. It was designed to ensure that those who hold property and that those who hold wealth in America will never be subject to the subordination of the masses of working American people by the electoral system. That's why the Electoral College system exists. That's why, unlike the electoral systems in Europe that have parliaments and if
and
the opposition, yeah, if a party doesn't get 51% of the vote, he has to form a coalition government and bring in other forces. But in the United States, winner takes all. This is why Trump is able to expand the executive reach of power and force at the drop of a hat. That's why he's deploying military into U.S. cities in order to provoke the type of response that he needs in order to justify the complete subjugation of any type of resistance.
I hate to rush you off of the topics, but the time is limited. I want to get Brother Craig in because he got to go too. So that's another reason why we got to go.
Well, this tying in what you're saying, that you were mentioning how it was the communists who represented the force that was stopping fascism historically. Looking at that history, looking at the United States, other places around the world, maybe even having to speak hypothetically and theoretically since we're on the radio. But what type of organizing and education and action do you think the left needs to be doing, or that is called for today, that will be effective in combating this fascism and moving the revolution forward?
It's a very good question. I'm glad you asked that, comrade. I think that what we have to do is we have to see that there is a sea change in American consciousness regarding certain areas of U.S. foreign policy and domestic policy. People are beginning to see through the patina of capitalist pretenses to equal opportunity and employment. These crackers are saying the silent out loud today. What's this Banyan was talking about just the other day? They asked a civil war on the horizon in America. And he said that we are in a historical moment in which our very survival as America, which he means a Eurocentric, ethno-Christian, a dominated America, is being threatened. And it's being threatened not only by migration, it's being threatened by so-called enemies within that Trump has identified. So what you're asking is what we need to do now is we need to lay the groundwork for an alternative to the duopoly political parties, the duopoly political system, because both of these systems are controlled by finance and corporate capital. They do not represent the interests of working and poor people. And this is becoming apparent now with the government shut down. People are seeing exactly that they are powerless in the face of this. So we need to organize a united front against fascism. We need to organize a massive independent united front. And we see by the demonstrations, the No Kings demonstrations that many of us know was designed to encapsulate this energy, this anti-fascist energy that these kids are starting to exhibit after the demonstrations and the repression over last summer. We see that they use the term king in order to make it look like what Trump is doing is about an individual rather than about a system, rather than about the rise of fascism in all of the metropoles. Nobody uses the word fascist. It's like a curse word. Okay? And the reason why they go back to the feudal notion of kings is they're saying, well, it's this guy. He just wants to run everything and stay in power and make money. It's not that simple. We are talking about a system that has evolved into what can best be called democratic fascism. A system that African people and black people in the United States have suffered under since Reconstruction. And so homelessness, the lack of free health care, all of these things are typical of the fascist state, you know, and the consolidation of giving tax breaks to the rich while militarized police stomp on the backs of the poor is the rise of this type of thing. And so what the enemy has done, like they have done with the Black Lives Matter movement, what they have done is they misrepresented what this movement is. They're making it look like it's just Trump. And it's just these crazies that he has around him. That once we get rid of them, we can go back, you know, to bourgeois democracy. We can go back to a serious democracy. Look what happened after the McCarthy era, when the McCarthy era was a cover for white supremacy and anti-Semitism. Almost all of the people that were marched in front of the McCarthy hearings were Jews. They murdered Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, who were Jews. The Communist Party was strongly European Jewish formation. And so they use communism as a shield to employ anti-Semitic repression. And they use racism. Look what they did to Paul Robeson and the black members of the communist movement at that time. So we are back in this. Now they're using migration and immigrants as the cause of this. They're saying they're criminals. We got to get them out. And they're building new detention centers. Corporations are making money hand over fist, militarizing the police. They're moving so fast that these ICE agents can't even put license plates on their cars and emblems on the cars. They're just white vehicles without license plates. They just bought them wholesale from Ford and GMC. So what I'm trying to say is what we need to do is we need to organize a united front, offer that same anti-authoritarian energy that's out there. And this united front could form the basis before the next national election for a third political party, for the development of a third political party.
So you're suggesting that electoral politics should be?
No, I'm suggesting that we should take a note from the enemy, that we should divide and conquer, that we should organize the masses of people who already are suspicious of government, both the Democratic and Republican parties. We should take that consciousness to a new level. And we have to challenge these definitions that what we're witnessing is not a white supremacist attempt to maintain a white-only apartheid system under the guise of democracy. We have to speak truth to power. We have to say that this isn't just about the authoritarian move of the MAGAs. This is about the rise and consolidation of the corporate state and their power and the subjugation of working people to the oligarchies and the rich and this techno-feudalism that's evolving today. We need to use those terms, and we need to use those terms to define what is being done rather than talk about the Republican and Democratic parties and there's a left wing here and there's a right wing there.
Right. That's true. That this obscuring, this abstract left right kind of thing, binary, like it's not more complex. But let me it's hard not to ask you a complex question that requires a whole lot, and we still got a little bit of time. wanted to expose people to some of the conversation we were having earlier today, tying in like the fact that this state is like killing people in the open seas with impunity and Venezuelan people. And also we were talking about the, because let me put it this way. So to say this is a white Christian ethno state is also, some people would challenge it and point to some of these people in the Congress, black Congress people and all that, who are challenging, you know, trying to challenge or stand up to the current government. But then these kind of things, to me, in my view, confuse people as away from what you're suggesting, because people have to wrap their minds around what you're characterizing, because we have this buffer class that obscure the realities, comparable or black misleadership, that kind of thing. And that also, anyway, let me just leave it there and see what your response is, because it's hard to do this in such a small time.
You're absolutely right. And once we define this as a misleadership class, we have to step to them. We have to remove them. And this is what the process of building an anti-fascist united front really does, because we have to propagate solutions and not just talk about problems. We have to talk about community control of public safety, for instance. That's something that we have to mobilize in the face of the rise of militarized policing and ICE agents. Once we begin to talk about that, we could talk about decoupling certain relationships, like, for instance, the mayor's ability in most cities to appoint a police chief. The police chief should be vetted by a community public safety board of citizens and people who are elected from the grassroots, not appointed by the governor, not politically beholden to unions, and not politically beholden to interests in law enforcement. The other thing, too, is we have to begin to define what we mean by public safety and security, and stop talking nonsense like defund the police or other such ridiculous notions. You're not going to defund the police in a police state. The police are the armed agents of the state. And they vowed to serve and protect. They serve the rich and they protect the property of the wealthy and the corporation. That's their job. Okay? So police brutality is not an aberration. It's an essential ingredient in controlling the black colony, in controlling the black masses. It's about terrorism. It's about intimidation. So that black folks could come up and say, oh, well, you know, you can't talk about resisting because they'll squash you. They have tanks and they have all this stuff. Mm. And so, you know, we have to understand that liberation doesn't begin from fear. Liberation of a people, if you want your freedom, doesn't begin with you being afraid. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that you're suicidal and stupid and that you would engage in certain inappropriate activities. However, to answer your question, electoral politics is not the solution, but we should divide and conquer. We should widen the gap between the so-called neoliberal left of the Democrats and the neoconservative right of the Republicans and all those in between. We have to identify them as instruments of white supremacist control, mm-hmm. instruments of class oppression, and so that people would move away from even talking about our issues in terms of Republican and Democratic Party. This is why it's important that we have to bum rush these silent Negroes sitting in the Congressional Black Caucus and ask them, why haven't they come out and condemned absurd debates like labeling the new mayor of New York a communist jihadist?
Mm-hmm.
Only because they're throwing around these terms, a communist jihadist. That's like calling Muslims atheists. Mm-hmm. And so we need to understand that our elected leaders are supposed to be challenging these terms.
Right.
But the reason why they can't challenge these terms, because they have no grounding in history. They're just voices and symbols of power. And I want to end with this. We have more black elected officials in positions of power than we've ever had in our entire sojourn in America. And we have absolutely no political power.
Mm-hmm. And as we were talking about before, the culture, I guess, the revolutionary culture, radical culture, used to be that the people wouldn't even let them get away with not having a position on mm-hmm. these things. You know, now, so that in some ways it's a failure of the left, so to speak, or radical left, us. We need to be organizing to make it so that they can't just be up here not doing anything, or they have to take a side or get out the way. All right, brother. Thank you so much. Daruba Ben Wahab, Black Liberation, Pan-Africanist, Revolutionary Pan-Africanist, veteran in the movement. Thank you for joining us. Always a pleasure.
thank you, and thank you, Comrade Craig, for hanging in with me. And I appreciate the both of y'all. Y'all take care of yourselves and watch your back. Peace.
All right. Peace.
That concludes our show for this week. This show included a comic relief clip of Bill Burr. Thank you for listening, and tune in to Voice with Vision every Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and follow and like Voice with Vision on Facebook.
Keep your radio locked here for Crossroads with Roach Brown and Martine Moore Brown, and Nkechi Taifa up next, who I believe will also be talking about the curfew. Remember, make an effort to stay politically educated, organized, and committed to the fight for the liberation of your people. Or fall back.
It goes F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people.
Come on.
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your freedom. We are L-I-B-R-B-G. We live F-R-E or D-I-E. We lace music with culture, something to bring us closer. Kick truth, the young black youth like we supposed to. No swine in our rovers or Louis Vuitton holsters. We in the trench with young 50 cent and street soldiers. The ones they ain't lock up and send the foreign waters to fight for something they ain't got in their own borders. It's us, the free unit, they ain't holding us back. We score the soundtrack to this movement. Y'all just rap, brat, black on black and clap about that. State trooper shot with Severly's boy in the back. Miss Rogers boy in the back. While we ain't firing back, the boys is gone and they ain't coming back. We gotta go back, San Cole for right and exact. It's the red, green, and the black. It go
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K.
Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people.
Come on.
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your freedom.
Good news, family. You can now take WPFW everywhere you go with our brand new WPFW radio app. Stream Jazz and Justice live, listen to archived shows, view the program schedule and playlists, donate, and more, all right from your phone. Download the WPFW radio app today from Apple App or Google Play Stores. WPFW in your pocket. Jazz and Justice wherever you are.
Thank you, family, for standing with WPFW during our fall drive. Because of your support, we shared powerful moments. The No Kings protest, the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March, and a moving all-day broadcast on the struggles in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Listeners in the Congo downloaded our radio app, tuned in, and sent us messages of gratitude, proof that your generosity connects people around the world. We came within $30,000 of our goal. If you are able, please help us close the gap and keep WPFW strong. Go to our website at wpfwfm.org, where you can donate or get our P.O. Box number of where to send checks. WPFW, Jazz and Justice, people-powered radio, connecting our communities globally, while building a better world, one broadcast at a time. The Capital Area Food Bank is offering free food distribution for federal workers starting now until the government reopens. Federal employees and contractors will need to show a government work ID to receive food. Distribution times and sites are as follows. Tuesdays, 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. at No Limits Outreach Ministries, 7721 Barlow Road, Hyattsville, Maryland. Wednesdays, 10 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. at So What Else, 6116 Executive Boulevard, North Bethesda, Maryland. Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at United Community, 7511 Fordston Road, Alexandria, Virginia. Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at Urban Outreach, 5343 C Street Southeast, Washington, D.C. Saturdays, 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. at Linda Ben Foundation, 10739 Tucker Street, Beltsville, Maryland. WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
What's it do if you're approached by the police?
We deserve to be safe in our neighborhoods.
Follow these tips to assert your rights.
If you're being stopped, detained, or arrested, the best thing to say is nothing.
Stick to only these questions. Am I free to go? If stopped by law enforcement, try to leave the conversation as quickly and safely as possible.
Ask, am I free to go?
If yes, walk away calmly and quietly. Running away could give them pretext to detain you. Officers may try an incite a reaction. Ignore them. Knowing your rights is a great first step.
And asserting your rights is even better.
Hello, I'm Dr. E. Faye Williams, National Chair of the National Congress of Black Women. And you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.